Good morning. This is More Talk Radio, and my name is Cecil Prescott. You're listening to KBOO FM 90.7 on your dial in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, and 100.7 in Corvallis. The time is approximately 8:03 in the morning, and we are joined by two guests who will enlighten and take us on a journey as we discuss a topic that has been at the center of much conversation, not only locally, but also nationally. Let me remind you that you are listening on our radio, and we invite those of you who are listening to be a part of our conversation. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. And I'm looking for confirmation. Those are the correct numbers. Excellent. This morning we are talking about immigration, and a lot of has been talked about, not only locally but nationally, about immigration. We thought it would be helpful for our audience to continue our conversation with people who have been active in addressing the issues locally and nationally. This morning, we're joined by representatives from the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. They'll introduce themselves, but they've been active in organizing the faith community, educating the faith community around the issues of immigration, and organizing the faith community in action, both locally and nationally. Hopefully, we'll have a discussion this morning which will touch upon the issues that are current, but also give us a historical perspective so that we will understand how we got here and have a perspective or perspectives on where we should go. Joining us this morning, and I'm so grateful for them joining us at this hour, are Marco Mejia and Beth Poteet from the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Cecil.
Thank you, Cecil.
Well, as I mentioned in our introduction, you can barely turn on the radio without hearing stuff about immigration. And we thought it might be helpful to get a little bit of perspective. And we thought it would be helpful for you as representative of the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement to give us a perspective on who you are, what you're doing, and particularly so much of we hear in terms of public discourses around religion and faith. And I thought it might be helpful to get a perspective you might give us in terms of what's happening in faith communities, why immigration is an issue that faith communities are addressing, and tell us something about why those of us who may not even be part of faith community ought to be concerned about this. So maybe we can begin by sharing a little bit about yourself, but more importantly about your organization and why you do the work you are doing. So the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement tells me that there was an old sanctuary movement. Is that the case, Marco?
Yeah. I remember now we had a national meeting last March, was it? And I don't know, but it was actually last year in June when we had John Five, that he works in the border and is in the when they campaign the No More Deaths campaign, and he is a pastor, right? I don't remember which congregation he is. Do you?
Sure. So he, if you want me to talk a little bit about him, so he was the pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. During the 1980s, is that where you're kind of going?
Yeah, no, and also, see, because the word new and old, I wanted to, and he reminded us a little bit that this is not the old or the new, but it is kind of the process of continuing and the building of, you know, our mission, if you wanted, you know, of as faith people and faith communities. Giving a response of faith. And so saying a little bit of that is that the old and new is a word that just helps us to understand that we are more current around this decade, that what or the past decade that started, you know, 4 years ago, and connected to already a background that we come from something, and that's the 80s.
So share something about the background, because when I said the old, I'm thinking like the Centroid movement in the 1980s, Central American
exactly.
Solidarity. Help us to remember what that was and where we are now. Why is it different?
Well, yes, if we all remember, it's not that back, you know, in history in the 80s. There were a lot of conflicts, armed conflicts in Central America and in South America, too. One of the strategies that the United States had was to try to control those governments in a time where there was a lot of a critical thinking and the need of the countries to look for their own self-interest and self-determination. I know a lot of people will say they were kind of democracies and free countries, but in reality they weren't. So that led to a lot of wars that were already there for many decades, you know, like Nicaragua and the end of the 1800s, Cuba, so many countries. But the 80s was when there was a lot of the civil wars going on and a lot of people had to flee, you know, just to get away, you know. And so because they were in very high danger of being killed, or persecuted, or just to live in the middle of a war, you know what it means for somebody. So they were getting out of those countries, mm-hmm. you know, El Salvador, Nicaragua, etc., and looking for a place where they can go and live, you know, in peace if you want it. So one of the places was the United States, not the only one, mm-hmm. but it was one. And when they came here in the United States, they met with a big wall in problem that the United States won't allow them to come in as refugees from those wars.
These were people fleeing conflict in their home
exactly.
countries, seeking, well, literally, sanctuary.
Sanctuary, mm-hmm. if you want it, yeah. And for a place where to live, you know, exactly, sanctuary out of the protecting from those wars and persecution and death, pretty much. So in that situation, you know, as anyone should know, you know, it's very difficult for any person to come to the United States, unless you're a rich person in another country, you can get a visa, right? Mm-hmm. So they need to come, and in order to come, they were saying no to many of those people. And the connection in between the faith communities that we had locally here in the United States that were doing missionary work and connected to churches in Central America, they knew what was going on and facing it, you know, firsthand, actually. You know, many religious people were even killed in Central America as a product of this war. So they were facing it, you know, firsthand too. So they had a challenge of what to do about it. And understanding and not understanding at the same time why the government in the United States didn't want to let these people come in, when in the United States, in other cases, you know, a lot of people were allowed to come, like the Vietnamese, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of, or not just as an example, or other people from other countries. Where the United States have been acting, you know, and involved in those wars too. So that's what happened. And
so there were individuals, or you mentioned the pastor or churches who opened their places of worship for these people who were coming into this country.
Right. Okay. So to pick up on what Marco was talking about, actually, what happened was the United States would not grant Central Americans refugee status like they did people from other countries, because we were actively funding and orchestrating those wars. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, in the early 1980s, people were just starting to kind of flood across the border, especially through Arizona and Tucson. And there were two people, John Fife, who Marco mentioned, who was a Presbyterian pastor, and Jim Corbett, who was a Quaker layperson. And they really started the sanctuary movement during that time. And what happened was Southside Presbyterian Church started housing these folks who were coming through and providing protection for them, and then helping kind of people move through an underground railroad system, basically then to other congregations throughout the United States. And at the height of the sanctuary movement at that time, which was around the mid to late 1980s, there were over 500 congregations throughout the United States who publicly declared themselves sanctuary, saying, "We are providing hospitality in defiance of the law, which says that to harbor someone who is undocumented is illegal." And there were these 500 congregations who said, "We abide by a higher moral law, and we're going to break the law if we need to in order to protect people's lives. In addition to that 500, there were many, many more congregations who were providing support and hospitality to people without being public about it. So these were just folks who said, we are going to publicly defy this unjust law, believing that they are called to a higher moral law.
And so this was an era for some of us who don't remember or were not around. Ronald Reagan was president. There was a lot of names like Oliver North and things that was happening. So there was a lot happening in Central and South America, response of some faith community and other people in responding of welcoming people here, and while also trying to seek changes in U.S. foreign policy. If we could put that down for a moment and fast forward 20 years, things have changed, governments have changed in Central and South America. But there's apparently a need for sanctuary. There are still people who are crossing the border into this country. And from what I gleaned from what you were saying, times have changed and circumstances have changed, but there was a need to continue organizing to welcoming these people. Why are people, why is there a need for another movement now to welcome people? And is the movement similar in terms of causes to why people were moving to this country 20 years ago?
Maybe I'll start, and then Marco has, I know, something to add to that. So what we saw during the 80s is people were fleeing for their lives because they were being persecuted with guns. And now we see that people are fleeing for their lives because they're running from hunger and poverty, which is not actually very different from what was happening before. In 1994, as many folks know, NAFTA was passed, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was a trade pact between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The idea being to open up trade markets between those three countries would kind of lift all boats. Well, that didn't happen. Basically, what happened, especially in southern Mexico, is that the agricultural economy was devastated by NAFTA. Because in the United States, we heavily subsidize our corn industry and other agricultural commodities. And in southern Mexican states like Oaxaca, Chiapas, Guerrero, all these kind of states where there's large indigenous populations, they've been largely ignored by the government of Mexico over decades. What started happening was cheap corn basically was being imported into the Mexican economy, flooded the markets, and then poor farmers who have, maybe an acre or 2 acres of land where they're basically growing their own crops for their own subsistence, were not able to compete with those corn prices. And so what happened is that we've seen since NAFTA was passed, the estimate is more than 2 million farmers, corn farmers, lost their jobs because of NAFTA and then were forced to migrate to the United States.
So this is corn from the United States going to
Mexico, being dumped on their markets at a price that's cheaper than people could produce for themselves. And now we're seeing the same thing happening in Central America with CAFTA, which is the Central America Free Trade Agreement. It's the same agreement as NAFTA. It's just extended between the rest of Central America and the United States. And so now we're seeing more immigrants coming from Honduras, from El Salvador, from Guatemala, these countries that have been really devastated, not only by CAFTA, but by kind of the precursor to that, this move towards trade, neoliberalism and liberalization, that's really just about increasing profits for the richest corporations out there and not really about protecting workers, both in the United States and abroad. So I think part of it is maybe people aren't being persecuted with guns anymore, but they're definitely being persecuted with poverty and hunger, and they're making the decision, I can't feed my family. What am I going to do? I'm going to go to the United States where I can make at least a little bit more money. I know I'm going to be exploited. It's a dangerous journey to get there, but I'm going to make that decision, that really tough decision, to cross the border because I don't have any other option. And I've been to southern Mexico. I've been to Chiapas. I've been to Oaxaca. I've been to Central America over the last 10 years and heard this story over and over and over again. And we hear it when we talk to immigrants here in the United States who are part of our network. It's the same thing. I didn't want to come here, but I was forced to come here because I'm an economic refugee, basically. I don't know, Marco, if you have other things you want to add to that.
Well, yeah, a little bit. And, well, kind of in the same way that you're helping to define this, to understand, is that what you're talking about is about the free trade agreements, you know, the and the North was the NAFTA, you know, with the end and the beginning. And I think that, that's something that we need to understand in the historic context and how that is very connected to the 80s, and not just the 80s, but way before. I think that for many of us, you know, we understand that the United States is the most powerful country in the world, right? And that is not just something that happened because God wanted that way or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's because that has been one of the interests, you know, of this country. And we've seen it, you know, for already hundreds of years and how that started. So it is important for the United States to have the level of life and the wealth that this country has, and that the only way to accomplish that is through a control, you know, a military and political and ideological control. And it started regional and in the continent, and now it's universal, right? That's mm-hmm. we talked about the global. Everything is global now, and the power is global, and who decides globally, et cetera. So that's important to understand how that comes to place when people in the control of the economy happens in that way. Mm-hmm. And so the thing about the free trade agreements basically is what we understand here also. You know, the concept of freedom has changed so much now that it's important to understand. Now, freedom, when we put it and read it in the paper and listen to politicians, because the people from the corporations, they don't come, you know, out front in the media to tell us mm-hmm. that it's the politicians and the government, you know, are the ones that kind of they safeguard, you know, all this, because the corporations are the ones that are producing the wealth and are the powerful people that are behind it. So after I you know, that said, it's just to understand that what is happening is trying to keep that control. That has happened every minute, you know, of all these last years and decades and years and years. So the people outside of the United States understand that mm-hmm. much better because they live that. Right. And and I'm going to finish with this part. And it's interesting that what Beth said, you know, that now we are starting to feel it internally here. Because I think that the power of these corporations, these powers are going out of control in terms of, I'm saying, that now it's the people in the United States that's living and going through that, you know, the huge crisis that we have, poverty, mm-hmm. unemployment, etc. It's a product of that power to be maintained, you know, the bailouts and everything like that. So just to put a little bit of context to later, you know, understand mm-hmm. why immigration happens, mm-hmm. which a lot of people don't think about all of these things, that there's a huge consequences, but there's a lot of causes that have been produced, and those causes actually have been created here in the United States.
I think those are very important points that you make. You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. We're here this morning with Marco Mejia and Beth Poteet from the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. And we're speaking this morning about immigration and hopefully to learn more about the origins and the background for our modern-day political crisis, for lack of a better word. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com if you have a question or comment for either one of our guests. Again, this is More Talk Radio. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. I thought it was very helpful for both of you to share in terms of the background, because I think many of us maybe just begin the day by turning on the television or open up our paper and saying, oh no, who are all these people? Why are they coming here? We need to do something. And so I think it's helpful to get a background so we can put things in context and understand things better.
Well, and I think, too, just to recognize that unless we're part of the Native American community here or were brought as African Americans, were as slaves, you know, most people migrated to the United States who were white for the similar economic reasons. So we talk about this a lot of times when we do presentations in congregations, is we have this immigration timeline, and we ask folks to think about their ancestors and when they came to the U.S. and why they came. And when we have that discussion, you can kind of see the light bulb go on and realize, wow, you know, my family came because they were poor farmers in Germany and Ireland or wherever, and they were come seeking a better life. And so then we make the connection that it's the same exact reasons that people are coming from Mexico and Central America, is they're looking for a better life. Either they were fleeing a war, like your family maybe was, they were persecuted because of religion or race, or because of economic reasons. And so just to make that connection that if we see ourselves, that we are all, you know, part of this community as well, and that we have a lot in common with our immigrant sisters and brothers, you know.
Talking about having a lot in common with our immigrant sisters and brothers, and I was struck by the way you used that term, brothers and sisters, because much of the argument that much of the debate we hear is them versus us. And I think one reason why I wanted to speak with you and to learn more about your organization is to learn more about why you organize in faith communities, why that's important, and the message that you are taking to the faith communities and the messages you're receiving from the faith community. Given that movement has always happened, people seeking a better place and welfare for their family. And you mentioned earlier in terms of NAFTA and CAFTA, the historical background. Could you share something more about the organizing that your organization is doing, and when did you start it? And then we'll go to a couple of callers. Another one, welcome.
Sure, I'll start. We started in 2006 after we learned about the situation with a woman named Elvira Arellano, who is a Mexican national living in Chicago. And she got her final order of deportation and decided to defy it and went to her church, which is a Methodist church in this Puerto Rican neighborhood in Chicago. And she asked for sanctuary, kind of again in this tradition from the 1980s. And they said, of course, we'll welcome you with open arms. So she and her son lived there. Her son is a U.S. citizen. He was born here. She lived there for about a year. And then after a year, she decided to leave the congregation and to do a speaking tour throughout the United States. She went to Los Angeles, gave us a presentation at La Placita, which is like the big Catholic church in downtown L.A., came out, 20 ICE vehicles physically surrounded her and her son and pulled them, ripped them apart, and deported her that day.
And ICE is?
ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, used to be known as the INS, which is now under the Department of Homeland Security. So when we first heard about Elvira's situation back in 2006, Marco and I and another woman named Sarah Luz were part of the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, and we said, you know, we've got to do something about this here because we know this is the same problem is happening. People are being targeted with raids and deportations and home detentions who are just trying to feed their families and are, you know, good folks who are contributing to our communities, and this is an unjust situation, and we need to do something about it. So we started working and organizing, and then in 2007, there was a big raid at Del Monte, the immigration ICE raid. Many folks remember it was the largest raid in Oregon's history. Over 165 workers were detained. Out of that came a group of women who eventually came to be known as the Committee of Solidarity and Mutual Support. And so faith communities really responded to that incidence of the raid and said, what's happening is unjust. It's not fair that families are being ripped apart. And we can get more into that. But to answer your question about kind of the moral imperative or what's kind of our philosophy or where we're coming from, you know, if we look at Hebrew scripture and Christian scripture, so if you take that kind of in total, providing hospitality to the immigrant, the alien, the sojourner among you is the most often used or quoted kind of commandment, basically, if you will, throughout that text. And we really take that to heart. I mean, the story of the Hebrew people was an immigrant story. Jesus himself was an immigrant when he was a baby. His parents were basically forced to flee and go to Egypt for a while. So we see that within, especially the kind of Judaic and Christian tradition, there is this kind of theme that runs throughout about being immigrants, and how you treat immigrants really reflects on who you are, and that to provide hospitality and love and support to those people is extremely important. And so that's really where we draw kind of our basis in what we do and why we organize in faith communities. And faith communities understand that, and they really respond to that. And I think that's why we've seen the growth of this movement so quickly, is that people really do identify with that message of providing love and hospitality. It's fundamental to how we practice our faith in the world, and they see that. And even though this is a controversial issue, and every time we go into a faith community, there's never 100% agreement on this. But people really do understand, I think, the values of providing for those in our midst who are suffering, and that we are sisters and brothers. We are part of, you know, basically God's family. And, you know, we're all in this together. I don't know if you have anything to add.
I'd like to say that one of the main motivators of it also is that what was happening in 2006, you know, there was the Sensenbrenner bill that was passing in Congress. And if people remember, you know, that really created a pretty big response from a lot of communities and immigrant communities and non-immigrant communities too, even though the media was showing that it was just immigrants and undocumented immigrants coming to the streets. And it was pretty much a lot of different communities that felt that the immigrants are not them, as you were saying before, but it's us and part of us. And that was happening to our community. This bill was a very, very radical anti-immigrant, you know, that violates the basic human rights of people and the immigrants in this case, and not just them. But it was going to criminalize also faith communities and churches. It was going to criminalize, you know, especially the basic, one of the basic missions that the faith communities have, which is provide help and support to the needed without any discrimination. And a lot of communities, you know, have and support things with programs that also immigrants participate in those programs. And this bill was proposing that everyone that has a contact or provide something or transport somebody, or that you know, knowing that somebody is undocumented, that you will be also persecuted and by law. So that was totally terrible, you know, that persecuting you because you need to help, which is actually one of the basic, parts of our culture as a country too in the United States, mm-hmm. right? Which is compassion, going out to the world and save people and help people in need, if we help people here and there. Yeah. But internally, we were kind of going to the opposite, you know, and the opposite. And the second thing that I like to say is that, you know, the effect of that is that also the criminalization of immigrants. It's really important to understand here and why that is getting to what you were saying, you know, this anti-immigrant sentiment. To people that really don't know the history, don't understand, you know, why people immigrate and don't understand why they themselves, their ancestors, immigrated also here, that still happens and it will happen historically. So in the past, you know, as we were saying in the history, you know, they will have scapegoats, you know. Before was kind of everything that was related to the communists, you know, mm-hmm. there was a war, so there was something where people will put the you know, some distractions to the people here, you know, and crisis that happened, you will blame something. And nowadays, it's the immigrants that are blamed for everything, you know, and they have taken the immigrants.
As the new scapegoat, as you mentioned.
Yes.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. This is KBOO-FM. My name is Cecil Prescott. We are joined here this morning with Beth Poteet and Malcolm Mejia from the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. We've been discussing this morning their organization and immigration. We gave a little background, historical background, and we will continue our discussion. Hopefully we'll share more about the work you're doing. Talk maybe about what's going on in Arizona, response, are there anything similar proposed here in Oregon? But let me remind you that this is Talk Radio. We want to talk with you. We have a couple of callers online. We'll go to our first caller. Joanne, good morning.
Yes, hello. I wish you folks well in your work. And I'm very frightened and worried about all the events that have been happening in our country, the Gulf, and even in Pakistan and Haiti and all. And I get a sense, even though it may not make sense to anybody else, I was a child in World War II or before when World War II was happening, and I get a sense of this. First they came for so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and then when they came for me, there was nobody there for help. But anyway, in the meantime, I don't want to make you uncomfortable with this question, but it's been on my mind because of all these events happening. Do you think that the Mexican government and the U.S. government want the U.S. to bring in our military troops in Mexico and deal with the drug people there? Anyway, I listened to the program, and as I said, I wish you all well in your work. Goodbye.
Thank you, Joanne. And that quote was from Martin Niemöller, a German pastor.
Right. So I think, Joanne, if I understood your question correctly, was wondering about why the U.S. is basically supporting the drug war along pretty much the U.S.-Mexico border and the Mexico-Guatemala border. We don't talk a lot about that in our work, but I will mention briefly, I used to work for Witness for Peace, which is a Latin America solidarity organization, and they did a lot of work around the drug war in Colombia and U.S. funding for that, and starting with now what's happening in Mexico with what they call the Merida Initiative or Plan Mexico, which is based on Plan Colombia. And basically, you know, the lesson that we learned in Colombia with U.S. support for the drug war was that it was a failure. It didn't actually reduce drug production in Colombia. It only really actually served to increase the violence there. And I think the thing that we have to remember is, and there have been studies around this, and the statistics are, you know, it's 23 times more cost effective to fund drug treatment and prevention programs in the U.S. than to put money towards interdiction efforts around the drug war. And it's not to say that this isn't a very serious issue that we need to look at. But we also need to be really concerned and aware of the human rights abuses that also just go kind of hand in hand with this kind of funding and the way that the U.S. government is conducting itself in these efforts. So it's a very serious problem. I don't know, Marco, if you have anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, it's kind of, again, using something that apparently it's a war on something really bad, right, on drugs and production and distribution and all of that. But also has been used this thing to persecute people from the labor movement, organizations, community organizations that have been, you know, organizing the people to demand from their governments, you know, to change the situation and, you know, end poverty and et cetera, you know, unemployment, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So through that also, so then makes it think that it's not just the objective of doing, you know, the war on drugs. It's also the objective, as I said before, you know, remember that the control is important, the military control and the political and economic control in order to keep, you know, that serving to our purpose as a country too, and the corporations. And that's part of that. So just to say it. And bringing back a little bit, you know, to immigration, I think that's interesting and important how that reflects, you know, this way of resolving everything with violence, with the military, in a military way. It's happening internally here. And we were talking about ICE. You know, ICE sounds very, very cold, right? And it is. Because it's, as Beth said, you know, as the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And really what it is, it's really a new police that was created after September 11 when things changed. And what was the INS, you know, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, changed and to be part, a main part of Homeland Security, because it was seen now immigration as a threat, mm-hmm. you know, because then they used more to say that these people that came were immigrants, right? The ones that flew the planes in New York, etc., and the terrorist attack were immigrants. And they totally related and scapegoated more immigrants, you know, seen as one threat in that sense, because we are criminals. We're illegals, you know. And it's important to understand those words in terms of how we got to the point right now that we have, you know, what happens in Arizona. And it's a really very, very, very hot issue right now, you know. And it's pushing people to take a place on it. And usually what it is to push people to put in between the really, you know, criminals, terrorists, immigrants, illegals, you know, all of those words together, that threat to your security and makes you feel a lot of fear. Or, you know, the other side is pretty much, you know, the respect of the human being. Mm. So it's that kind of thing what's happening, you know. So it's important to understand that's happening also internally.
Internally, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Beth and Marco from Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. Let's go to our next caller. Michael, thank you for waiting.
Yeah, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah, the guy just touched on basically some of what I was calling for, that Americans, they can identify with the terminology of settlers. That's what they called their plight when they came to America. They didn't identify themselves as immigrants. They identified themselves as settlers. So what you guys need to do is change your terminology from immigrants or immigration and start identifying people as trying to come to America as settlers, because Europeans can relate to that. Even over in Israel right now over in Palestine, when they're going over there taking their land and everything, they don't call themselves immigrants. They're calling what's going over there settlers. So I think you should change the terminology. You should identify yourself as settlers. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Language is important. Yeah. Let me read this announcement and then we'll continue. That coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour. Topics include organic and sustainable agriculture and the global and governmental response to widespread flooding in Pakistan. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus is not on today. Instead, we'll hear If You Love This Planet, and Dr. Helen Caldicott talks with author Chris Hedges. We went to school together, Chris and I, a long time ago, about the consequences of combat and the descent of military culture. At 11, on Sounds of Awareness, the guest is B.T. Kimbrough, editor of Dialogue, a magazine about coping with vision impairment. And at 11:30, we'll hear Dr. Sherry Speed, founder of Chimpanzee Rescue Center in Cameroon, talking about saving chimpanzees and gorillas. All of this here on your community radio station, KBOO. But presently, we're speaking with Beth Ann Marco from the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. We're speaking about immigration. We're speaking about foreign policy. We're speaking about making the world a better place for all.
Amen.
Thank you.
But continuing, share something about the work that you are currently involved in. You mentioned that, you know, a few years ago when the Del Monte raid, that was an organizing you organize around that. And since then, I know that you've organized in many different faith community. And it has extended beyond Judaism and Christian. And I think that's important for you to share. So what are things you're doing in different faith communities today? How may they become involved if they have questions? I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I'd like to explain that what the Sanctuary Movement is, the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement is, and Beth is going to help us with that. Okay. But just to start saying is that, you know, we are an interfaith coalition, which means it's not only Christian or Christian denominations, but also it's to all other expressions and other denominations or congregations of faith, you know, Muslim, Jewish, et cetera, et cetera. So it's important to understand that it's all of that, you know. And Beth can help us with our...
What we do? Sure. Thanks, Marco. So we kind of have three different work areas. One is what we call our prophetic hospitality. So when folks who are undocumented are affected by an immigration raid, if ICE comes to their door and does a home detention, or they're deported, we provide some immediate assistance to those folks and hospitality for them. But really what we try and do is build relationships of mutuality and support and out of solidarity. So it's not... that we are there to kind of be a paternalistic force in their lives, but really to build relationships with each other and to provide some immediate support, because people are in crisis situations when that happens. And especially if you don't have a lot of social support here, it can be really, really tough. So we do that. Another piece of our work is to do a lot of just kind of education, going to congregations, faith communities, talking about these really tough issues, exploring what our value base, you know, what is our value base and how does that inform how we work with immigrants or treat immigrants in our midst? And just doing a lot of public education and really trying to change the debate. And I appreciate what Michael, the caller, said earlier, you know, thinking about how we use language and all of those kinds of things. And then the third piece of what we do is more of our kind of action-oriented side, which is our Love Has No Borders campaign. And it's really focused on working for a just and comprehensive and humane immigration reform. We've been really active in responding to what's been going on with the Senate Bill 1070 in Arizona, helping to organize along with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and some of our other partners, some interfaith vigils in response to that, along with the Immigrant Rights Coalition, which we're a member of here locally in Portland. So just really being a public face from the faith community that, you know, we don't agree with these types of policies and we want to see a different kind of politic basically in the U.S. And we're going to stand up and be counted. So those are kind of our three basic work areas. And if you're interested in getting more involved with us, our phone number is 503-550-3510. And our website is www.oregonsanctuary.org. That's www.oregonsanctuary.org. And we'd love to be in touch with you and maybe come and give a presentation to your congregation or see how we can work together to move this work forward. And we know that there are lots of congregations who are not necessarily involved with us but are doing this kind of work with their congregations, have congregation members who are undocumented and are doing support with them already. And so we really want to applaud and support all the folks out there who are doing this really important work.
Great. We have a caller online, so we'll go to our caller. Steve, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for the show. Hey, I just want to say, first of all, I'm for immigration, but I'm against people coming into the country undocumented. And also, you know, as an American, I'll just say, you know, as a white person going into Mexico, what do you think happens to us when we go over there and we're the federales come and ask us for our papers? I can speak from personal experience. I'll tell you what happens. You get an AK-47 and a 45 Glock pistol put to your head as they ask for your passport de turista, ahora. So, you know, when we think about America and our you know, how we're going about things, I don't think, you know, you look to our neighbors and where these people are coming from, the horribly impoverished government, just toilet of a country, it's horrible. And I do think those people, you know, deserve better. But, you know, we're just trying to do things in a way that, you know, I do think these people deserve better, but at the same time, it's we have to have some rules and regulations. And, you know, these people are risking their lives coming across the desert. That's ridiculous, too. And, you know, I just think, you know, hey, I'm just not for illegals, you know.
Okay.
Hey, my grandparents came over on a boat, waited on Ellis Island or waited in San Francisco.
Sure.
And they were fleeing Europe where it was very tough and Yugoslavia, what have you. Hey, I think, you know, just because, you know, our neighbors to the south. And, you know, it is not all of America's fault that Mexico is so just a horrible country. It's not our fault. It's not all of our fault. They need to take some moral responsibility for impoverishing their own people. I'm all for helping them, but let's just do it in a right way. Thanks
okay. Hey, thanks, Steve, and thank you for your comments. Not uncommon thoughts, and please respond.
Yeah, I think that thanks for that, and that's one of the a lot of the message that we hear, you know, here and there, and we come and talk, and that's why one of the reasons that we have a campaign, which is an educational campaign in terms of understanding the root causes of immigration. Because there is a number of things that the caller said that it's very interesting to to link to that. And one of those is that it sounds pretty horrible when you get into Mexico that they put the gun on your head. And I don't think that happens usually. And if you're white, actually, you know, I think that they treat you more. And I'm not saying that that's something that, you know, they welcome you or not. I think it's pretty much welcoming. But that's something that to distract us a little bit from the main issue here, I think, in terms of what really is happening in the United States. It is happening also in other countries, and kind of the trends that are producing that are the same. You know, I am thinking, you know, when you see the gun, we need to ask ourselves, where did they get the gun? Who sold it to them? And what interest was behind it, making business to sell guns, to be able to do that, you know, to you and to the Mexican people or other people in other countries. So what I'm saying is that the responsibility that needs to be taken is to the ones that create, you know, that has been creating historically all these problems, the big problems, you know. Why, you know, Mexico, the Mexican or the Latin Americans or the Asians don't have another Ellis Island to be waiting as your ancestors, right? In the United States already, and come here and to be processed to, you know, get integrated into this community. And one thing that, you know, I want to say is in terms of what I said before, in the terms of the language that we use, is that is the us and them, and separating, you know, what is happening in between a people and a community, that when we talk in terms of economic things, in terms of military means, we understand the world as our world, us. You know, we have the right to go to Iraq. We have the right to go to Colombia. We have the right to go to so many countries because we understand that us, we want to help our people in the world. But when it comes to really face the situation of immigration here internally, then it's them.
Well, it seems as if I heard in part several things from this last caller. It was certainly that us and them, but also I think he said in one sense, I'm for immigration, but I'm against illegal immigration. He'll share compassion about the economic difficulties people face, but also conflicted about how they get here.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, Steve, I think your comments are shared by a lot of people, this kind of confusion around or tension about wanting to be empathetic and understanding the conditions that people are coming from, especially if you've traveled in Mexico. But the breaking the law piece really kind of is a hang up for folks. And what I talk about and has been helpful for me to really understand is that there are very few ways that you can actually come to the United States with documentation. So if you have money, if you have a certain type of job, or if you have property, those are basically the only ways you can get a visa to come to the United States. So if we look at the people who are the most desperate, who are the most affected by these policies, are people who don't have property, who don't have money, and who are not, you know, basically computer programmers or star athletes. And so there's no line for them to get into. I mean, they just can't come with a visa. So that's why they're making that decision. It's not like they're saying, oh, you know, I just don't want to go through the process. There's no process for them to go through. And I think a lot of people don't know that. And the way that the U.S. immigration system is set up, it's this hodgepodge of who gets to come from what countries and who doesn't. So there's this kind of quota system that's, you know, very political in a lot of ways. So, for instance, you know, we have a policy with Cuba, the like one wet foot, dry foot policy. Well, if you make it to the United States, you know, and you're Cuban, basically you can stay here because we have a certain relationship or lack of relationship with Cuba that we see those folks basically as refugees, whereas we wouldn't see, you know, people who are poor and fleeing economic conditions in Mexico or Central America as refugees. And so they don't get that same policy. So, and we also have to realize, like, historically, the way the immigration system was set up, it was very, very racist. You know, it allowed people from basically Northern Europe to have priority. Southern Europeans were either in, at some points in history were seen as kind of outsiders and were not given the same opportunities to come to the U.S. as Northern Europeans were. And I mean, we can talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act. We can talk about, you know, people from other Asian countries, African countries, and even Latin America who were not given the same priority and ability to come to the U.S. as Northern Europeans were. So we have to kind of look at that whole history and realize that the way this system is set up, it's just crazy. I mean, it doesn't follow any systematic rules or guidelines. And it's very unfair to the people who are in the most desperate situations.
We have a couple of callers online. I'm going to pose you a question and think about it, and we'll go to the callers. Hearing both of you comment and also Steve comment, and it occurs to me that we hear often, again, we need comprehensive immigration reform. It seems as if a few years ago there seems to have been some sort of consensus building around comprehensive immigration reform where all people could get on board. I don't know where that is today.
Right now it's a pretty difficult situation because there is no comprehensive immigration reform proposals out there. Mm-hmm. And what's out there is pretty much, you know, we came down to really do what the Sensenbrenner bill was proposing to do in the past, you know, a little bit less than what it was proposing, but there isn't really out there. And what there is, again, you know, a proposal that most of the bill or the bills that have been proposed, you know, the couple or the concept papers that they said, it's based on enforcement. Especially enforcement, you know, the border, more money for building the border, more eyes in the military in the border, etc. But not really getting to what we're talking about today, which is the real causes of migration and how we can affect that. And we can affect that, you know, and help, like the last caller said, you know, how and why things also happen in Mexico and other countries, in the Plan Merida and the Colombia and et cetera, et cetera. If we go back in history, how the influence of the United States and others too, you know, the powers in the world have been influencing and creating those situations too, and it doesn't take. And I agree that we need. So what I'm asking is also that we don't need to keep accountable, you know, the regular citizen here, but we internally have to keep accountable our governments because they have been producing that, and the governments who they represent really, which is not. Sometimes they represent us, right? But most of the time, there's these interests behind.
This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Marco and Beth from Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. You may contact them at OregonSanctuary.org or call them at 503-550-3510 to learn more about their work with faith communities in terms of education, advocacy, and their programs. We have about 2 minutes. We have one caller. Let's see if we can get that caller in. Good morning, caller. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your discussion, and it's really good to hear voices of compassion. I feel so irritated. As a First Nation person of the United States, Canada, and Mexico, you know, this government is based on not only racism, but hypocrisy. Because the European Americans, who are the dominant culture, are keeping out First Nation people. Mm-hmm. First Nation people of northern Mexico didn't have borders. Neither did a lot of tribes up in Canada. You don't hear this kind of talk about Canada right now, but if you look at it historically, this is based on genocide, and this is continuing. and it's based on the color of people's skin, and it's based on economics. And I just feel total disgust and despair. We have not begun to have freedom in this country. And I thank you.
Thank you so much, and for reminding us how much we have to do. I want to thank Beth and Marco for joining us this morning from the Oregon New Sanctuary Movement. For information, again, you may contact them at 503-550-3510 or OregonSanctuary.org.
Thank you very much. The last word I will say is that based on what the callers, you know, said, is that what we need to do is what we did today here, and we need to create a dialogue about this in our communities, in our churches, everywhere, not a confrontation. And how things are going is leading us to a fight, to a confrontation, not really to solve things. So we need to create the dialogue, you know, and saying and listening to each other and get to some point and learn from each other and get to some point, a positive point that lead us to, you know, to a place that's a better place for all of us to live together in as a community.
Exactly. Thank you. And thank you, Cecil, for inviting us this morning.
Thank you all. Thank you for listening to KBOO. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour. Have a great day.